Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
From the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network for movie talk, this is Historic Hollywood, spotlighting the most influential and founding members of Hollywood.
Welcome, Internet, to another edition of Historic Hollywood, a celebration of the cinema of yesteryear and the people who made it. Follow the network on YouTube, YouTube.com/PopcornTalk. The network is also on Twitter, at ThePopcornTalk. I am Lex Michael. My Twitter handle is at TheLexMichael, and I am here with...
Byron Thompson. My Twitter handle is at Byron Lee.
Carrie Bible. My Twitter handle is at FilmRadar.
Today, we are talking about Marilyn Monroe, an icon. Such a big life with so much information that we actually had to split it up over two episodes. So this is part one of a two-part discussion of the life and career of Marilyn Monroe. Now, the last couple episodes that we did on Val Lewton and Howard Hawks, and I opened by asking you guys how you came to them in the first place. And I was wondering if you guys have a specific memory of when you first noticed Marilyn Monroe.
She's so ubiquitous. I mean, I like a lot of people, I knew the image before I knew the artist.
Yep.
Because you see her on t-shirts and mugs, and I mean, she's everywhere.
Yep.
It's kind of so saturated. When I was in high school, I saw Some Like It Hot on television, and I just thought she was fantastic, and it's such a good movie. It works on so many levels, and of course, she's at the center of it. So that was kind of my first introduction to Marilyn. And then later, she's so impactful when you see her on the big screen. So later on, I got the opportunity to see some of her films on the big screen, and that's really a lot of fun as well.
Sure, yeah. But Byron, what about you?
My first interaction with her was through a film that came out in 1980 called Fade to Black.
Okay.
The lead character played by Dennis Christopher is a huge Marilyn Monroe fan. He's obsessed with her. And I, at the time, not really knowing much about her, didn't really understand. And he recreates a scene in the film from The Prince and the Showgirl.
Okay.
With Marilyn Monroe and Laurence Olivier. And
yes.
I was like, Marilyn Monroe is in a film with Laurence Olivier. And then, of course, they made that film, My Week with Marilyn, which is about that
yes.
exact experience. So that's kind of what turned me on. That was like 80, I think, or
okay.
so.
It's interesting because I was thinking about that question, and the answer that I kept coming back to for myself is an utter lack of an answer because Carrie, like you said, she is so ubiquitous that I genuinely cannot remember a time where I wasn't aware of her on some level. It's only fairly recently that I've actually started to dive in a little bit more to the work she did as a performer, separate and apart from Marilyn the icon. But yeah, it is interesting how rare it is that there, and we talked a little bit about this before we got on mic, there aren't too many people over the course of history in entertainment that have ascended to icon status in the way that she did. So for me, I don't know. I don't know when I first noticed because I feel like a part of me was always aware. Even if I didn't know what the image represented, I was always aware of the image. To me, there wasn't really a time before Monroe. And to the rest of the world, there was very much a time before Marilyn Monroe. She was born in the L.A. County Hospital on June 1st, 1926, and her birth name is Norma Jean Mortensen. And she was the third child of Gladys Pearl Monroe, who was a negative cutter at Columbia Pictures. Gladys already had two children with her first husband, but he was already out of the picture. They were in his custody off somewhere else. Marilyn didn't even know she had a sister till she was 12, I believe, and they didn't meet until she was already an adult. Now, Gladys married Martin Edward Mortensen in 1924, but they separated after only a few months, and it was before she became pregnant with her daughter. So to this day, as far as I know, the identity of Marilyn Monroe's father is still unknown. It is still a big old question mark. Now, Gladys, her mother, was unprepared for caring for a child. And so she placed Norma, as she was then known, with evangelical Christian foster parents named Albert and Ida Bolander in Hawthorne, California. And Gladys attempted to play an active role in her daughter's life. She would live at the Bolanders periodically to care for her daughter herself. But work shifts at the studio forced her to leave her daughter there and move back to Hollywood in 1927. And she would visit on the weekends, and she planned to take her daughter back when she was able to. And finally, in June 1933, she bought a small house near the Hollywood Bowl, and they shared that house with lodgers. In 1934, Gladys had a mental breakdown, and she was hospitalized. And while she was hospitalized, she was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and she would spend the rest of her life in and out of hospitals and institutions, and past a certain point did not have a great deal of contact with her daughter. So already it's not the brightest, happiest opening to the story.
But in that story, one of the things I was just curious about, she kind of fell in love with Hollywood, very much so. And I was just curious if you had done some background on her going to the Chinese. I know that she had had different, I guess, people that took care of her, that took her to the movies a lot. I know that she was a big Gable fan.
Yes.
I was just curious what you had to say about her love of Hollywood, so to speak, because that was the draw from the beginning, right?
Yes. A good deal of the information that I found, specifically as applies to what you're talking about, the passion, the love for it, most of the information I found takes place a little bit later. Once, not when her career already started in earnest, but as she was emerging into the entertainment business. So a lot of the information that I found in that regard we'll get to in a little bit. In the meantime, she was declared a ward of the state after her mother was institutionalized. She was taken into the custody of her mother's friend, Grace McKee Goddard, who took responsibility for her and her mother's affairs. She lived with lodgers from the Hollywood Bowl House until June 1935. She would later tell a story about how when she was 8 years old, she was assaulted sexually by one of these lodgers. And, you know, how do you... I don't want to belabor this specific point too much, but at 8 years old, how do you process that when you have no consistent support structure? How do you process it at all, but especially when you have no consistent support structure behind you?
And no father.
So. And no father. Where do you...
No counseling. No one to follow up and get you the help that you would obviously need to...
How do you process something like that? She was briefly fostered by her mother's friend, Grace Goddard, and Grace's husband, Irwin Doc Goddard, before being placed in the L.A. Orphans Home Society in September of 1935. Grace became her legal guardian in 36, but Monroe, Norma, only lived with them until Grace's husband, Doc, made inappropriate advances. I'll leave it at that.
So that's twice.
That is twice. That is twice in a relatively short amount of time.
Kind of following her around.
Yes. So after that, she stayed with either her relatives or Grace's relatives in L.A. and Compton. She found a more permanent home in September 1938 when she began living with Grace's aunt, Anna Atchison Lauer, in West L.A. She was enrolled in Emerson Junior High, where she wrote for the school's newspaper. She attended weekly Christian Science services with Lauer. Due to Lauer's health issues, Monroe returned to live with the Goddards in Van Nuys by early 1941. After graduating from Emerson, she attended Van Nuys High School. In 1942, the company that Doc Goddard worked for required him to relocate to West Virginia. Now, under California law, they were not permitted to take young Norma out of state with them, and she faced a possible return to an orphanage or similar facility. The workaround that they came up with was to have her marry their neighbor's 21-year-old son, James Doherty, who worked at the Lockheed Corporation. And there seems to be a little bit of debate among biographers whether they had already been dating or if this was purely an arranged marriage. But the two of them were married on June 19th, 1942, just after Marilyn Norma turned 16, and following that, she dropped out of high school. And she was not tremendously happy being a housewife. Yes.
No, I'm just listening.
Yeah, so she was not terribly happy, as I think you might imagine, was not terribly happy being a housewife. She would later say that the marriage didn't make me sad, but it didn't make me happy either. My husband and I hardly spoke to each other. This wasn't because we were angry. We had nothing to say. I was dying of boredom. In 1943, Doherty enlisted in the Merchant Marines, and he was shipped off to the Pacific in April of 44, and he would remain there for most of the next 2 years. Monroe, Norma, moved in with his parents and began working at the Radioplane Munitions Factory as part of the war effort. In late 1944, she met photographer David Conover, who had been sent by the U.S. Army Air Force's first motion picture unit to shoot photos of female factory workers to boost morale. They took a bunch of photos with her that ultimately weren't used in any publication, but she began modeling for Conover and his friends, and he encouraged her to apply to the Blue Book Modeling Agency, which signed her in 1945. And it was during this period that she first dyed her natural brunette hair blonde. So that is the genesis point of that element of her look. Now, she began a modeling career. Her figure was deemed more suitable for pinup type images than for fashion modeling. So she was employed largely for advertisements, for shoots for men's magazines. According to Emmeline Snively, who is the head of the agency, Monroe was one of their most ambitious and hardworking models. By spring 1946, she had appeared on the covers of 33 different publications.
Just like with the Betty Page, I was just curious, do you know if she did at this point, because I know this is early, any of the like kind of lingerie type modeling, or was this all just professional straight across fashion stuff?
My assumption, based on the greater,
because I know later the iconic Playboy cover, but I mean that's quite a ways away from this. This is what she's like. You're saying how professional she is and how hardworking.
But to the best of my knowledge, a lot of it was a little bit risque because that was the type of work that people saw her as being most appropriate for
and paid for,
and of course the people there. it's a job's a job, right?
Sure.
So. Snively, the head of the modeling agency, arranged a contract for her with an acting agency in June 1946. And through them, she met Ben Lyon, who was an executive at 20th Century Fox, and he gave her a screen test. Now, Daryl Zanuck, who was the head executive at Fox at the time, was not super pumped about her screen test and wasn't all that keen to sign her. But when he found out that Howard Hughes, who was heading up RKO at the time, had seen her on a magazine cover and wanted to sign her himself, he said, no, we can't let that happen. So they signed her to a contract. Now, in 1946, her contract began, and she and Ben Lyon together selected the name Marilyn Monroe for her. Lyon picked Marilyn because he apparently was reminded of Broadway star Marilyn Miller. And the name Monroe was picked by Marilyn herself as a tip of the hat to her mother's maiden name. In September 1946, she was granted a divorce from James Doherty and dove headfirst into her career in earnest.
That was the guy that escaped, right?
The one that went out. The one that went out to join the Merchant Marines.
Ran away?
during the first few months of her contract, she wasn't working. She didn't have many film roles. So she dedicated much of her time. Carrie, we were talking about this a little bit before we went on mic, dedicated much of her time to trying to learn as much as possible. She would take classes. She would take acting classes, singing classes, dancing classes. She would spend time on the studio lot just to watch other people work to get a sense of their jobs and how it all fit together. Now, her contract was renewed in February 1947, and in the spring of that year, she was given her first two film roles. She had 9 lines as a waitress in the movie Dangerous Years and a 1-line appearance in a motion picture with the wonderful title of Scudahoo, both for 20th Century Fox. Fox enrolled her at the Actors Laboratory Theater, which taught the techniques of the group theater, the famous, conclave organization of some of the icons of various acting techniques. Her Fox contract wasn't renewed a second time, and she returned to modeling. She continued to model, take classes. In March 1948, she landed her second contract for Columbia Pictures. Now, according to biographers, this was arranged for her by Fox exec Joseph Schenck. She was allegedly his mistress at the time. Some modifications at this point were made to her appearance. Her hairline was raised by electrolysis, and her hair was bleached even lighter to platinum blonde, the iconic platinum blonde hair that she would maintain for the remainder of her career. She had her first leading role in 1948's Ladies of the Chorus for Columbia Pictures. It was her first time singing on screen. It was a B movie, disappeared pretty quickly, and Columbia, when the option to renew her contract came up, opted not to do so. And after she left Columbia, she became the protege of Johnny Hyde, who was vice president of the William Morris Agency. He began to represent her, and their relationship soon became, let's say, romantic in nature, although she refused many requests from him to marry her. He also allegedly paid for silicone prosthesis to be implanted in her jaw, and possibly, depending on who you ask, for a rhinoplasty. And he also arranged for her to appear in the 1949 Marx Brothers movie Love Happy in a little bit part. Now, she appeared in several films released in the year 1950. Now, some of them were unremarkable films. She had small parts in the movies like Ticket to Tomahawk and The Fireball for 20th Century Fox and Right Cross for MGM. But she was in two films from that year that met with a great deal of critical acclaim. One is All About Eve.
Eve.
Yes. For
love that movie.
It's a tremendous, tremendous movie from director Joseph L. Mankiewicz. And the other is 1950's The Asphalt Jungle, directed by John Huston.
Yes. The Asphalt Jungle, basically the plot of the film can be summed up by saying a group of criminals pull off a heist, but bad luck and double crosses send everything unraveling in this crackerjack film noir directed by John Huston. It's got a terrific cast, gorgeous cinematography from Harold Rawson, the great cinematographer. And Marilyn Monroe has a small role in this film, but it's a really, really good one. She plays the mistress of, what is Uncle Lou, or what are they?
Uncle Lon.
Uncle Lon, that's it. That's an Uncle Lon. And
Who's married as well, and you see his wife in the film.
Yes. And you know one thing I notice about old films that I think is so great and we don't do anymore is the very first time you see a star, their introduction, if you will, in the film. That's so important in old movies, and we've kind of lost that. But the first time you see Marilyn in Asphalt, she's sprawled out, lying on her back on the couch with her face up, and this great shot of her, and it's just, it's a hell of an introduction. Do you know what
Absolutely.
I mean? It really is, and darn it, they don't do it that way anymore. They don't do star introductions, but she's really good in the film, and of course she has a big dramatic scene when she finally breaks down and sends the alibi into the ether.
She can't lie,
even though that's what she's living. And
sure.
Yeah, she's really, really good in the movie. She's sexy, she looks beautiful, and she is, there's not a weak link, you know? I mean, it's a great ensemble film, which is rare at the time, and that she held her own against a really excellent cast, and she delivers under John Huston's direction. She's excellent.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's interesting. The movie, we were talking about this too a little bit before, we got on mic. We were talking about when people talk about The Asphalt Jungle, it's largely classified as a noir, at least conversationally by most people. And we were talking a little bit about how it didn't play like a noir to us, or it didn't to me. Anyway, the two movies actually that I was reminded of the most while I was watching it, one was, I think maybe the most obvious comparison, for me at least, was The Killing.
Of course, Kubrick.
The Kubrick movie, right, in which Sterling Hayden also appears and plays a very similar role.
But in both films, specifically The Killing and Asphalt Jungle, as Carrie was saying, they're, since you were trying to move it away from noir, which I think is appropriate, and I'm sure you probably feel the same way, they're character studies.
Yes,
much,
absolutely.
Much more so than the noir thing, because Carrie outside was saying, you know, she was thinking when we watched all the films, they're so, you know, dramatic. Even the Clash by Night, it's like these are not necessarily what we would define only as noir. But you said it even better. But I think the characters were really why we didn't see it that way, especially in the Asphalt Jungle.
Yeah.
Asphalt Jungle almost has kind of an Italian neorealist look
absolutely.
To it. And I'm a huge fan of Eddie Moeller, the czar of noir. I go volunteer for him at the Noir Festival in L.A. every year. And I recorded his introduction to this film on TCM, and I was watching it today to prepare. And in his introduction, he said that Louis B. Mayer absolutely hated Asphalt Jungle. He called it a piece of trash and said he wouldn't walk across the street to see it. And then, which I thought was kind of an interesting quote. But then again, Mayer had very sentimental tastes. So something of this nature was not going to be his thing. But Of course, as the cliche goes, one man's trash is another man's treasure.
Indeed.
But yeah, I think Time has obviously proven Asphalt Jungle is indeed a classic.
Absolutely. And the other movie that I kept thinking about as I was watching it, especially when you get to the end and you see how the story resolves itself, I was reminded a lot of Jules Dassin's Rififi, which is a movie I'm a huge, huge, huge fan of. And it's very similar in structure, where you meet this gang of criminals, they come together, they plan the heist. There is a big heist sequence as the centerpiece of the film, and it's really a wonderful examination of these professionals doing their work. And then, of course, things go very, very badly for the criminals in
that
movie as
well.
But those two. So it's interesting that it now I'm wondering what heist film, I guess, is the most apt tag for that genre. But it feels like it doesn't quite do justice to how much is going on in that type of movie. But there are several of them that I can think of offhand.
But I'm sure this film alone, this film combined with All About Eve, really raised Marilyn's profile considerably.
Absolutely.
That
Absolutely.
Year.
Truly.
I mean, these are both Oscar-nominated films by A-list filmmakers from major studios, so that had to have drawn, you know, a lot of attention.
And I don't want to move on too quickly, because while we have the opportunity, I mean, it's worth saying a few words, I think, about All About Eve. No?
Yeah. Oh, God. I always want to talk about that one. Turned 65 recently. 65 years ago, that movie came out. It's so literate. It's one of the most incredibly well-scripted movies of all time. It's just so great. And even though Marilyn's in it only briefly, she's got some great lines in there and some great comic touches that she sort of brings to this very dramatic scene in the movie. And it's really a great showcase for her, actually.
Yeah.
And again, she holds her own. I mean, there's Betty Davis, Anne Baxter, George Tenet, I mean, these terrific titan actors in this film. And you know, she's good in it, too. She doesn't disappoint.
Absolutely. And I would agree, the combination of these films released in the same year did certainly more to boost her status than anything, any professional success that she had had so far. You know, these were, even in their time, they were big movies, and they were very, very well regarded.
No, I'm agreeing.
You give me a look.
No, not at all. I'm just totally agreeing you.
Yeah? No, what do you got?
I just remember that John Huston had said that The Asphalt Jungle is all about characters who are going against their nature.
Yes.
I was just thinking about that because you had said you didn't think about the heist film being the definition of what kind of film that was. But
I feel like it doesn't do it justice.
I was just thinking about how all the characters, even, of course, had Carrie said earlier, even the Monroe character, even she's going against her nature because, like she said, she's already living a lie, and then she finds out she can't even lie about that anymore. But every character is going exactly the opposite as to what we're seeing in the film, which that makes it a little different than a typical noir as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
And it's interesting, too, the type of part that Monroe played in that movie is a type of role that she would be asked to return to again and again. This wide-eyed, very sultry, very sexual, but very almost childlike innocence to the way that she...
Well, like when she kisses Lon, it's like we know something's going on, but she pulls back.
Yeah.
Even though clearly she's like a kept woman. It's everything in the movie is kind of like on a double level. There's nothing's very simple at all, even though it seems that way.
Right. So these movies were very successful in their time, and because of the acclaim with which they were met, Johnny Hyde, her friend at William Morris, was able to negotiate a 7-year contract with 20th Century Fox in December of 1950. Only days after that, he died of a heart attack. So she was devastated. She was dealing with a large amount of grief, but her profile only continued to rise. Now, she had supporting roles in a handful of movies in 1951, Hometown Story for MGM, As Young As You Feel, Love Nest, Let's Make It Legal for 20th Century Fox. And she started to gain notice in various publications as one of the brightest up-and-comers in the industry. Now, to develop her acting skills, she began, at this point, taking classes with the famous acting teacher Michael Chekhov. And she started really catching on with audiences at this point. She started receiving fan mail in large, large amounts. I mean, we're talking several thousand pieces of fan mail a week. Now, at this point in her private life, so the story goes, she was in a relationship with Alia Kazan. She also briefly dated director Nicholas Ray, actors Yul Brynner, Peter Lawford. In February 1952, she began a highly publicized romance with retired New York Yankees player Joe DiMaggio. Now, also in 1952, she was in a movie called Clash by Night, directed by Fritz Lang. And Byron, you made the comment that there's almost more to say about Fritz in relation to this movie than there is about Marilyn, because her role is not huge in this movie. I mean, Clash by Night really, Carrie, I believe the way you put it, it's through and through the Barbara Stanwyck show.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And Stanwyck is tremendous in this movie, but it is a noteworthy touchstone in Monroe's career because it was the first time that she had her name billed above the title with the other actors. Now, obviously, Stanwyck had top billing, but she was up there with them, which was a huge jump for her. It's based on the Clifford Odets play of the same name. Odets, probably best known for writing Waiting for Lefty, I would say. It's set in a small fishing village, and it's about Stanwyck's character. She returns home after a lengthy absence. She's had a marriage to, if I remember correctly, a politician of some sort. It's a little bit nebulous. They never really delve into it in too much detail other than to say he died, perhaps somewhat suddenly. And it's about this relationship that she involves herself in with a fisherman in this village. Monroe plays her brother's girlfriend. Were they – remind me, were they married in this movie? I believe they were just
– I think they were just seeing each other.
They were just a pair.
Right.
And
kind of feisty from what I remember. Back and forth a little bit.
Yeah. And it wasn't – you know, it's not – it wasn't a huge part, but
– she makes the most of it though.
Absolutely, and she is memorable. And she doesn't have a ton of a material opposite Stanwyck in the movie. They don't share a ton of screen time.
Not really, but she does a lot with Ryan.
Yes.
And she kind of does this triangle thing where she kind of wants to kind of almost fit herself in. It's almost like, see me? You know, can you see me? It's like she really pushes herself quite a bit as the character.
Sure.
Which only helps Marilyn, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Now, I did think it's interesting. I didn't know... I had no idea what the title referred to. Apparently, the title Clash by Night was taken from a poem by Matthew Arnold called Dover Beach. It's a poem written in 1851. And specifically, there was a line that says, it's a place where ignorant armies clash by night. And that seems apt.
For the characters?
For the characters in this. And it's very well done. I certainly don't take issue with it as far as the way the movie is... conceived or executed, but specifically the Robert Ryan character in the movie. There are some moments, specifically when he's asked to do, and I quote, his Chinese impression. It's a little not comfortable.
Well, it's a different time. I can't understand how anything could be judged in terms of, you know, the context is everything.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I know what you're talking about, but it seems to me like, especially going back to the play that you said that was quoted from, you know, these characters in a very, very different place. And the Ryan character, much like her returning home, the Stanwyck character, they all seem to be in this huge search for something.
Yes.
Not that anybody finds it, of course, but that's what the movie's all about, so...
I agree that it absolutely – moments like the one I'm referring to, and he when he's asked to do his Chinese impression, oh boy, does he, and he just goes for broke with it.
Yeah, it's painful to watch.
And that's the thing. It's in context, you understand. You get why this is there, but through the prism of being an audience member now in 2015 is yikes. Oof.
Well, you always have to think about context, though, when you watch movies, because they were, you know, they reflect a certain time, and that's
absolutely
part of it.
And on top of that, on top of obviously the clear difference in era and what was deemed culturally acceptable and what wasn't, these are meant to be not the most educated of people.
Well, especially him. I mean, that's kind of he's the roughneck, so to speak, out of all the guys.
Yeah.
And that's why I guess she's so obviously attracted to him.
Yeah. Yeah, that would
it's
do
almost,
it,
it's almost like the worse he is, the better he is to
yeah.
her. It's like the more attractive. Oh, he cares about nothing. That's the win.
There is one other moment that I just want to shout out in this movie, and it's the same as the Robert Ryan character again. And he talks about he's very drunk, and he's talking about his divorce from his wife and how he treats it in his head like divorce is as it just means one of them is dead. And so he tells everybody that his wife is dead. And the way Robert Ryan plays that scene, he's so plastered and so morose and so not belligerent, but aggressive in his morose delivery of this sentiment. And that moment to me is wonderful. And it does absolutely paint a picture, especially when viewed in concert with the other moment, of who this guy is. So I do think those moments work. They absolutely work in context. It's just some of them.
Well, they also help define when he's alone with Stanwyck, like when they're at the beach, and you have those moments where she's kind of discovering who he is as well, because we've already seen those type of flourishes, so to speak,
sure,
for him, his shortcomings. We see the whole picture. She only sees what she wants to see. And
exactly,
that's a big part of her experience, her journey, so to speak. You know, she returns home, and the Paul Douglas character, you know, he's clearly infatuated, you know, crazy for her. But we know, obviously, that's not going to work out. It's very much it's a very sentimental story in a lot of ways. It's very sad. Unlike the other two films that we're looking at. It doesn't quite have that level to it.
I would absolutely agree. It's a very good film. But it is very much the Barbara Stanwyck show.
It's bittersweet.
I would say that's very, especially when you get to the ending, and it ends on a reconciliation. So you could make an argument that it's a happier ending than it could have been.
But you said it earlier. I mean, it is a great film, even with all the sadness.
Oh, sure.
It's a strong film. It's just not necessarily perhaps be the most upbeat ending.
Sure.
Perhaps.
Now, around the time that they were making this movie, a little bit of a scandal broke out where it was revealed that in 1949, Marilyn had posed for nude pictures, which were featured in calendars. The studio learned of the photographs before she revealed this, and they decided to get out in front of it by talking openly about them while stressing that she only posed for them in a dire financial situation, bid to raise a little bit of sympathy on the part of the public. And I just lost my train of thought there. Whoa. Really gave birth to the idea of Marilyn Monroe, the icon, as a sex symbol. And she would begin to play into that.
Well, as I think Hugh Hefner said, she was sort of a one-woman sexual revolution. I mean, this is the 1950s. This is a very conservative time in America. And it's really remarkable that that didn't end her career. Because in another time, it would have.
Oh, sure.
So it's kind of really made Marilyn even more, you know, it was definitely a step on her road to becoming an icon, that nude calendar. And the fact that she basically joked about it, yeah, I just had it on the radio.
Yep.
And, you know, I think it really, her honesty about it and her willingness to kind of own up to it, I think really kind of endeared her to people at the end of the day.
Sure. Yeah. And I think the way the studio played that by getting out ahead of it and spinning the story the way they did was incredibly smart, because it made her a victim without making her, without really making her a victim. And it was interesting. It allowed it to be, I think, about as empowering for her as it could be.
Studios were brilliant at damage control back in the day.
They really were.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, in 1952, she was in another handful of movies. She had parts in We're Not Married, Don't Bother to Knock, Monkey Business for director Howard Hawks. And that was another early example of her playing one of these childish blonde characters who is innocently unaware of the impact that her, let's say, more sexual qualities were having on the people around her. And this really was when she started to find herself being typecast in these types of roles. She also had a cameo appearance in the anthology film O. Henry's Full House in 1952. But also around this time, she started to get a little bit of a reputation for being difficult on film sets. She would often show up late or not at all. She couldn't remember lines. She would occasionally demand that multiple takes were shot over and over and over until she felt more satisfied. She would depend on acting coaches while she was working, and that irritated a number of her directors. And these problems were attributed, depending on who you asked, when to anything from low self-esteem, stage fright, or the gradual escalating use on her part of barbiturates, amphetamines, alcohol, initially to aid with anxiety and insomnia, but as these things often do, it became a bigger issue.
But as we were talking about earlier, Lisa, as I was mentioning the My Week with Marilyn, I mean, this is all fairly well documented, but isn't one of the reasons why it worked so well for her is because clearly she just got more popular and could, in a sense, ask for more.
Oh, sure.
So in other words, I understood exactly what you were saying about all these problems. She would be like a terror on the set or whatever. But I think it's also pretty well documented, and I think even Carrie said something about it earlier. It's like, well, it didn't really matter because her stock just kept rising. So it didn't really matter. I mean, they'd be on the set and they'd be like, God, I don't want to work with her ever again. Even, I think it was Carrie that was saying, even on The Great, Some Like It Hot, you know, Billy Wilder was like, that's it for me. Because of all the problems, you know, that it gets to be too much. Even though she is very popular, she's such a draw.
Sure.
Well, I think in the Hollywood case, money is the number one thing. And as long as a star is making a lot of money, the studio is going to put up with whatever they have to put up with. But the minute that star stops making money, there comes a time when they're no longer worth the trouble. So, I mean, we probably even see that in modern day stars today. It's just, as long as their movies made the money they made, they were willing to, you know, deal with the baggage that sort of accompanied that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. Now, 1953 saw the release of a movie called Niagara.
Niagara is a film that's unlike anything she'd ever done before. And she, I think we were talking, she got her first lead credit on this film.
Yes, this was the first film for which she received top billing.
And director Henry Hathaway is kind of an old school director, and it's a very old school film, but it's kind of the film that sneaks up on you. It seems fairly subtle, but it's not subtle at all. It's actually quite a great film for her to kind of break out in a lot of ways. She is the definition of evil incarnate in this film. She is a complete monster, and obviously wearing every one of her traits to the fullest. And I feel no sympathy for her in this film, even though clearly, how could you feel sympathy for anyone who's trying to murder her own husband? I think the story's great. I think Joseph Cotten, who I'm not a huge fan of, practically steals the movie with his kind of sympathetic.
He's pretty fantastic
character.
I thought
he was amazing. I love the Max Showalter, who, of course, yes. Most people might be familiar with him from 16 Candles, among other things. Gene Peters is great. It's just one of those films that kind of sneaks up on you. I remember seeing it many years ago and not thinking much of it. Revisiting it this time as we were speaking outside, I think it's just an outstanding film. I thought it was great. Not so easy, I guess, to see, Carrie was saying, but you said it's available on iTunes?
I was able to find it on iTunes.
Great film from 1953. And definitely, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of Marilyn, that's, to me, where it starts. Because everything that you talked about, all the elements that kind of come together, she's in full force in this film. All the way.
Yeah, this was really, as far as I know, the first time you saw that
Absolutely.
Marilyn Monroe, you know?
It was almost as if like it was out of nowhere completely. And that's the character, though. So she gets to play on that, too. It's not like somehow she's trying to play Marilyn. She's that character for sure.
Yeah, and it's very difficult when she's on screen to look anywhere else, you know? It's interesting watching her play opposite Joseph Cotten, who I know really only from, well, he was in Kane. And he
Hitchcock.
Was in, some of the stuff with Hitchcock, but also Third Man, I believe, he was in as well.
Correct.
I haven't seen too terribly much of his work, so seeing him play this part, which is so far removed from what I am used to seeing him play, is interesting.
They also shot most of the film at Niagara Falls. So a lot of the stuff that you see in the films on location, which in a lot of cases, even in these old studio films, as Carrie was talking earlier about the way they did the damage control, they did so much stuff with rear screen projection and all that. But a lot of the stuff in this is actually there at Niagara Falls. That made a huge difference for me just because I've never been to Niagara Falls.
Sure.
I probably never will be, but the movie really gets the tone right with all that. It's very much placing you in that setting. And it really is kind of, even though it doesn't come off that way at the beginning, kind of is a thriller. It kind of is one of those type of movies that is a dark movie, in a great way, very enjoyable, I thought.
it is interesting considering how it is the only one, for example, of the three films that we have talked specifically about that is in color. And it's such a bright and vibrant and colorful movie. You mentioned it was shot on location at Niagara Falls. There are so many establishing shots of the falls that just look astounding.
It's amazing.
Because they're so bright and so colorful. So it is interesting to me, especially as we were before with Asphalt Jungle, talking about how it tends to get classified as a noir, but it does have that darkness, but we don't really find that it fits that description quite neatly enough. It's interesting to me that of the three, arguably the brightest, most colorful movie to me shares more noir trappings than either of the other two.
Oh, absolutely. That's for sure. And it's such a great showcase for everybody that's in the film, even though clearly we're talking about Marilyn Monroe, but everybody seems to just kind of tell that story. You were talking earlier about some of the films that other films remind you of. This really reminded me a lot, to some degree, shockingly, of both Cape Fears.
I didn't...
Because of structure things. Not because necessarily the story is similar, but because in a lot of ways some of the characters have very similar traits and they kind of carry out the same type of idea to... It's like no holds barred. They're going to do whatever they're going to do to get to that end point.
Sure.
And it just... And it, I'm not saying the movie's too long. It's not. It's barely over 90 minutes, but it just seems
It does go by really quickly, too.
It's pretty quick, especially in this final act. It really kind of moves along.
Well, just to maybe make the point of comparison to Cape Fear a little bit more clear, and I hadn't thought about it while I was watching, but now that you mention it, yes, I absolutely see the comparison. What, maybe we can go into a little bit more detail about what this movie is about, because we've only so far talked about the plot in pretty broad terms.
It's about a man who basically is losing his wife. And he doesn't even know it. She's having an affair. Marilyn Monroe's character is having an affair with basically anybody that comes along. Just in the case of this movie, the person that came along just happens to be there plotting the murder of her husband. And he really is kind of a nondescript, no-note character. But he, the husband, is trying to win her back. And this is kind of a sad thing in a film where Monroe is using a sex not just as a tool but as a weapon, because it's a very... For the time period, it seems to be a very open about sex movie. I mean, it's very clear what's going on between Monroe and the Joseph Cotten character. I mean, he wakes up and it looks like he's ready to like run a marathon, and clearly he's all excited. He's like this new guy, but all that does is empower her to basically follow through on the plans to kill him. I don't want to reveal to give away anything of the movie, but I think like I mentioned, Cape Fear, but also Jagged Edge, the film that was with Glenn Close, there's a lot of twists. Would that be the nice thing to say without giving anything away? And I thought that was the biggest surprise.
Yes, without revealing too much, I would say that is a pretty good...
And that's a big selling point. I thought was something that was great in the film.
By the way, I do want to add, Niagara is actually available on DVD. For some reason, I'm kind of a Luddite, and I had trouble downloading it, and I normally don't watch movies on my computer. I kind of am a huge, big screen gal.
But in print.
Yeah, it is in print. It is available. I don't want people to think it's not. It's just...
And it's definitely worth checking out for sure.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, I watched it on iTunes. But I would, in general... I mean, I say if you want to check these movies out, you check these movies out any way you can.
Because they're so worth seeing.
But... I don't think there's certainly no shame in opting for a physical copy over streaming, especially because a lot of these movies, you'll have other resources on that disc that you can learn from. I mean, we've got in the studio, if you're listening to us on iTunes, you can't see, but if you're watching us on YouTube, on the table, we have the DVD cases for both The Asphalt Jungle and Clash by Night. And as you can see, I mean, on the back, I know they both have audio commentary on them, so... I say in general, yeah, you watch them however you can. But if you really want to learn as much as possible, I mean, physical copies tend to yield the best trove of content if that is your speed. If you fancy yourself a bit more of a scholar than just a casual audience member, you're smiling at me.
Oh, I remember having Niagara. I used to actually have a hard copy of it. Unfortunately, I had to let it go at some point in time because I just remember, you know, things tend to change over time. But I agree with you 100%. You want to have the hard copy there's so much to gain from it. I'm sorry. Yeah, absolutely.
But there's something so powerful about seeing film on the big screen.
Absolutely.
I firmly believe that. And I there's some movies I won't watch until I get that opportunity, because I think seeing some certain things on TV would be just sacrilegious, if you will.
Well, yeah, and I think it helps, especially when we're talking about the era of filmmaking that we talk about on this show. A comment I made in the first episode is that for me, it's often difficult to get people that are, let's say, closer to my age to really engage with these movies. And I found that even though I'm now a huge fan of all of the movies that we're talking about, it did take a little bit of effort to teach myself how to watch them, if you will. And that's all the easier, no matter what film we're talking about, if you see it in the optimum, ideal way possible, which is obviously always in a theater.
And that's how they were meant to be shown originally, yeah, so...
And I agree with Curry 100%. I just think that when we're talking about all these films, and especially since we've been told that some people have been turned on to this stuff, even some of your friends and even some people that I actually know for a change, I just agree also that any way you can see it would be the way to go.
I agree with that, too.
Because I think we should all go to the American Cinematheque. I think we should all go when we get a chance to see it on the big screen. Unfortunately, whoever we're reaching out there, if they want to see Hawks or something that they don't have access to, I think, like you said, iTunes or however you can get it, because it's great. It's like gold.
And you can see there are a couple of movies. Last I checked, there are certainly a couple of movies, if not that we've mentioned so far, that we'll certainly be talking about in greater detail in part two, that are available on Netflix. Some of the bigger movies with Monroe in them.
Oh, absolutely.
I know, sure. If I remember correctly, I think Some Like It Hot was streaming the last time I checked, and there is a wealth of information to dig into regarding the production of that movie on the next episode. Before we move on to the last few pieces that we're going to cover in part one, do you guys have any thoughts on Marilyn in this phase of her career, everything that we've covered so far, any little bits and pieces, ephemera, if you will, that we haven't gotten to that you want to make sure that we get in?
Well, the only thing I wanted to say, now that you give me the opportunity, is I think that these three films are completely representative of everything that she ever wanted to be, from what I've read, what her ability was, and how she is as an actress. And I almost think that everything after this is kind of almost the downfall, because even though she does some amazing movies, it all leads to basically a career that's not going in the direction that this is going. This would have led to a very different career than what we're going to be looking at next week. And I love what we're going to be looking at, but it definitely shifted because, as Carrie said before, she was such a strong woman and she wanted to not only understand herself, but for lack of a better word, she wanted to exploit herself.
Yes.
For her own success, clearly.
Well, the problem is, she's too, aware though, of it. At the time, typecasting was so prevalent, and given her looks, she was going to get cast in certain kinds of roles, and trying to break out of that mold was a very difficult thing to do. And I think The Dumb Blonde is a comic creation, like, say, The Little Tramp or something. It's an invention, basically, because she wasn't stupid. I mean, it's sad that she lived in a time, not that things have changed that much, but where people say, if you're good-looking, okay, well, you can't be intelligent, too. Or, you know, I think people treated her like she was less because of her looks. But she took acting very seriously. I mean, we'll talk about it in the next episode. But she took a long time off to go to New York and study with Lee Strasberg and sit in the back of the class so she could learn about acting. She read the classics. She was a voracious reader. She even had later a clause in her contract that she had director approval.
Yes.
And if you look at the directors she's worked with, I mean, Billy Wilder, George Cukor, Otto Preminger, John Huston, this is not someone that is this is not someone who's fooling around here. She's taking her career and her acting very, very seriously. She had her own production company. So I think she's a lot more intelligent.
She created that just for that reason, correct? So that she could maintain the control and not have to be that blonde
maintain the
person.
Control, yeah. And I think there's so many movies that have been made and TV shows and even songs that try to solve the riddle of Marilyn Monroe.
Of course.
And at the end of the day, I don't think they ever will. I think the depths of her complexity of her life are something that we're all never really going to understand. We're just not. And I think, to me, the work is just, that's what she's left us with, you know? And that's what we have to go on.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because a lot of people don't want to look deeper. They don't necessarily care about the person beyond the icon. And, you know, there are, depending on who you ask, I mean, you get any range of opinions about her skill or arguable lack thereof as an actress, or whether it's a singer or a personality or whatever it is. Nobody debates the word that we started with, the ubiquity of Monroe, the icon. So to me, and that's why, at least on this episode, I wanted to jump in and dig around a little bit in her earlier life. So much of that, some of these things that happened to her, including, and in some cases especially, some of the less pleasant things that happened to her, the way she was treated, and the fact that she largely had to fend for herself, I think is very, very telling. And I think it makes a lot of sense when you look at the entirety of her career and the entirety of her story and, you know, ultimately where her story ended up. I mean, the portrait that is painted is I would say, a pretty tragic one. And I feel like people know bits of the story. You know, they know bits of the story about largely, you know, the iconography of it. And yes, everybody knows in general terms how the story ended. But there is, for my money, a very real, very sad human story under the icon that everyone knows and doesn't think about because it is so, I'll use the word again, ubiquitous. You can never squeeze ubiquitous into a conversation too many times. That's my general philosophy.
Well, the other thing is, I think besides the glamour and the beauty contrasted with the tragedy, I think the fact that she died young is another thing that also sort of sealed her reputation as an eternal icon.
Absolutely.
Because you don't get old, you don't gain weight, you don't make bad movies, you don't fade away, you just go out in a blaze of glory, so to speak. And to sort of die young, I think in a lot of people's minds, that's a very romantic thing. And if you look at people like Jean Harlow and Valentino and a lot of stars who've left us far too soon, I think those are the people that stay with us. Those are the films and the stars and the stories that people gravitate to, because there's that sense of the unknown. What would have happened to them had they lived? What could they have gone on to do? What could they have given us? And, you know, I think there's something really telling and also interesting and intriguing about this sort of unfinished life.
Yes.
That these people left behind.
Absolutely. And I think it says a lot about people in general, and it's especially true of what Monroe represents to so many people. This idea of somebody dying young and that version of the person being the version that you then keep forever because there was no version after that, it's something that I think people hold on to, especially as they age. You know, it is something that you can constantly hold on to, something that would remind you, I mean, not you guys specifically, but would remind somebody, say, of their own youth, their own beauty, these qualities that we all value for better or for worse, that as human beings, with the passage of time, sometimes slip away from us. And I think Marilyn, more than maybe anybody else, as a symbol, represents the antithesis of that, represents the eternal youth, the eternal beauty in the way you're describing. And so it's certainly no surprise that she has become the symbol she has become in the way that she has. I mean, it's to me very, very fascinating, almost as a psychological study, the way people respond to the image of Marilyn Monroe. Anything else? I mean, before we close out our first part of this conversation, is there anything else that you want to throw in? Because there's so many things that we could jump to, but I'm almost afraid to.
We've got another hour next week.
Yeah, there's so much to get into, and I'm almost chomping at the bit to do it. But is there anything else? Anything else from this, let's say, the first half of her story? Is there anything else that you want to squeeze in? Because there is so very much to talk about. But this chapter of the story largely represents the genesis. And I do think this gives us a really firm, expansive grounding upon which to build the next part of her story. So if there is anything, any final thoughts on this, let's say, the first half of Marilyn's story, her journey, her life, her work, so on, so forth, et cetera?
She's off to a great start.
Right?
I think so.
I think so, too. Carrie, anything? Any final words on the first era of Monroe?
I just say what I would always say to people, and that's see the movies.
See the movies.
See them all.
See the movies.
And there are so many really wonderful titles that we're going to cover next week. I mean, she would go on to be in movies like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, 7 Year Itch. Bus Stop. We mentioned Some Like It Hot. She would work with John Huston again on a movie called The Misfits, which we'll be able to talk a little bit about, because there definitely seems to be a differing of opinion where that movie's concerned.
I don't think there's a difference of opinion. I think we should speak also about the stuff that she wasn't able to complete.
Yes.
Because there was plenty of those projects as well that we can obviously talk about, because that's going to what you're talking about, the hope and the idea of what could have been.
Absolutely. Well. So there is so much more ground to cover regarding Marilyn Monroe, and that's why, as mentioned, we decided to split this episode into two parts. We are going to come back next week with the second part of our episode on Marilyn Monroe. For the time being, I am Lex Michael. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I'm on all the different things at the Lex Michael.
I am too at Byron Lee on Twitter and also on Instagram.
Carrie Bible at Film Radar.
So,
Twitter.
Yeah, so check us out. Check us out on YouTube. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Like us. Rate us 5 stars. Follow the network, youtube.com/popcorntalknetwork. Follow the network on Twitter at @thepopcorntalk. This has been Historic Hollywood. Thank you very, very much for joining us, and we will see you next time. Hands against the wall, like the drip, drip, drip of the raindrops when the summer shower is through. So a voice within me keeps repeating you.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, Christian Harloff, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the host only and do not necessarily reflect the views of its owners or principal.